11 verses 1 through 3. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible.
Last Sunday, we began looking at the unimaginable, unbelievable things that the Bible records happening at the hand of God. We saw that the Bible's first sentence confronts our imagination with the unimaginable. This is a direct challenge to our belief system as human beings. We immediately encounter God's creation of the universe. He commands each element into being, and he creates everything within 6 days. That is, by definition, unimaginable and unbelievable. We've never seen such a thing. We can't imagine such a thing. But we're not expected to understand how each element was created. We're expected to have faith instead that God exists and that he is able to do the unimaginable. What we read in Genesis 2 about a man naming all of the animals, and about a woman's creation. What we read in Genesis 3 about a talking serpent. What we read in chapter 5 of Genesis about people living hundreds of years. What we read in Genesis chapters 6 through 8 about this worldwide flood and all that's involved with that. What we read in Genesis chapter 11 about people building a tower into the heavens. And what we read in Genesis 12 about the promises that were made to Abraham. And then in Exodus through Joshua about God's mighty miracles in Egypt, in the desert, and in Canaan. All of this requires our faith in God, in his ability to turn the unimaginable into reality. These overwhelm us, don't they? When you think about all of these things, particularly those things in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, it's overwhelming how these stack one on top of another, one on top of another, and all really without explanation. And so these are things that we cannot imagine. They impress upon us God's power and God's nature and God's love. And they impress upon us that our faith in God cannot depend upon our understanding of how God does what he does. He's revealing his unlimited power so that people will believe his promises of a future, which is as unimaginable as what God has done in the past. After God's people were settled in the promised land, God limited his miracles. He periodically performed small hidden miracles like with Gideon and the fleece. And he occasionally did large visible miracles, as with Elijah and the consuming fire from heaven. But each time God did these unimaginable acts, he did them to remind his people who he is so that they would believe him and obey him. God was working through the world, not just his own people, and not just for the benefit of his own people. God was working through the course of history. He was using individuals, and he was using kingdoms to accomplish his purposes and plans for the future. And God used ungodly leaders and ungodly kingdoms to accomplish his purposes. But how he used these ungodly leaders and how he used ungodly nations to accomplish his will and in his timing is unimaginable. And it's unbelievable. How could God work in the lives of people who don't believe in him to accomplish his will, his purposes for his future? You can't believe these things. You can't imagine these things unless you believe that God is who the Bible says he is. And yet, despite all of the unimaginable wonders that God performed for the benefit of his people, they did not believe his promises of blessings for obedience and threats of curses for disobedience. God did not give up, though. God continued to speak through his prophets, and he foretold among them a king whom God would send to save his people. They liked that. That was very appealing to them, because so much of the time, Israel was a persecuted minority that fell under the power of great powers. The king that was promised by God would bring all people on earth under his reign. This, to the Jews, God's people, was believable and very desirable as they imagined it. God had given his people leaders in the past who saved them from slavery to ungodly people, so it was believable that God would send someone to deliver them, to redeem them. Kings typically extended their kingdoms to enlarge them, so that part was believable about this king reigning over all nations. But God's people could not imagine a king whose purpose was to save his people from their sins and to reign in their hearts. It was beyond their experience. It was beyond their understanding. And quite frankly, it was beyond their desires for a king. They were less interested in God reigning in their hearts and more interested in the king that would reign over other people so that they would be the power instead of other people having the power over them. So in his timing, in his wisdom, in his plan, God brought his son into the world miraculously in a way and in a place which God's people thought was unimaginable. You just don't bring a king into the world the way God brought his king into the world. And because of this, this king was unbelievable to them. They could not believe that this was the promised king. Neither that nor anything about him fit their imagination about their king. Because you see, they had an imagination. It just was their imagination and God's imagination were two entirely different things. As God's son, Jesus performed miracles which people today find unimaginable and difficult to believe. But in all fairness, so did people then. They debated over whether or not this man was actually from God. And if he was from God, they debated over whether he was the promised king or not. He just didn't fit their ideas of who a king should be, of where he should come from, and of what he should do. Matthew 14 tells about Jesus feeding a crowd of 5,000 people with only five loaves and two fish. And then he told his followers to take a boat toward the other side of the lake. He went up on a mountain to spend time in prayer. Matthew 14, beginning at verse 25, tells us what happened after that. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. Wouldn't you be? I would. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. Well, wouldn't you? I would. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." And Jesus said, "Come." Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" Jesus asked this question based on the fact that they had seen him do many miracles, not the least of which had been only hours before, feeding 5,000 people with a handful of food. If he could do all of those things, all of the miracles, and all of this feeding, then why would they doubt walking on water? Jesus told the apostles several times that he would be arrested, that he would be persecuted by the religious leaders, and that he would be killed, and that he would arise to life. But they didn't understand because, again, they had a different agenda than Jesus and Father God. So they couldn't imagine this happening. After all, that's not what a king comes for, to prophesy his soon death. And this whole idea of rising to life again, that was not something that people saw. They didn't experience that. They were not familiar with that. Oh, sure, they had seen Jesus bring his friend Lazarus back to life, but that was just something odd. And they were probably still processing, were our eyes deceiving us? Was Lazarus really dead? After Jesus arose from death, he appeared to his close followers. Luke 24 tells about him materializing in their presence. And it seems that not all of the apostles were there when this happened. Jesus appeared to these followers, and Luke 24 tells about him not only materializing, but walking through walls, just out of nowhere. Verse 37 says, they were startled and frightened, thinking that they saw a ghost again. He said to them, why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your minds? John chapter 20 and verses 24 on through verse 29 continues this story. Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where his nails were and put my hand in his side, I will not believe it. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. I imagine they needed peace. They thought they saw a ghost again. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Just before he returned to heaven, Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 and 17 adds, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. After seeing him repeatedly, they still doubted. I'm personally glad for these stories. I'm glad to read about how they were afraid of his visage, how they thought he was a ghost, how they doubted, how Thomas doubted until he could see him, and how even right at the very end, just before Jesus ascends into heaven, some are still doubting. I appreciate him because they make his close followers real human beings to me. I can identify with them. Can you? They had spent 3 years with Jesus, and during those 3 years, they had seen unimaginable things. Things like Jesus' transfiguration in Matthew 17. Now they saw Jesus resurrected from death. They saw him alive. They saw him speaking. They saw him eating. And yet, some of them doubted. They doubted this was real. Unbelievers say that the unimaginable things that are told about in the Bible are just primitive stories. They say that these stories were developed over time to explain what the people of those times did not understand about their world. But some things that have been believed for thousands of years to be impossible and unimaginable are today our reality. Think about this for a moment. A round earth instead of a flat one, and thus the ability to travel around the earth on the seas without falling off the edge. That was believed for thousands of years. Or travel by machines in the air, into space, and even to other planets. That was believed to be impossible and unimaginable, and today we take it for granted. We used to get excited when we'd hear about some kind of space lift. Now, we just shrug our shoulders and ignore it because, what's next on the news? Or machines which enable people to speak at long distances. We take for granted these little things we have in our pockets. And we don't think twice about the fact that we can pick them up and dial someone on the other side of the earth and have clear communication with them. Machines which enable people to move on land without an animal. That's a new thing. People could not imagine such a thing. That was impossible. You had to have a horse or a mule or a donkey or an oxen to pull a cart that you somehow got around in. Or you rode a horse. Or a long list of things done today in medical science. We can't even keep up with all the progress in medical science, can we? It's something new, not only every month or every week, but every day. And then there's radio and television and computers. And the list goes on, doesn't it? On and on and on. Today, we take innovation and technology for granted. But this is all new to the world. These things, not so very long ago, 100 years ago, were considered impossible. Remember the line in the musical Oklahoma? It's near the early part of the show. It's a song called They've Gone About As Fur As They Can Go. And they talk about all of these things that are in the early part of the 20th century that just seem to be, that's the end of technology. That's the end of innovation. And today we look upon that and say, how quaint. How absolutely quaint. And that was only 100 years ago. All of these things that I've mentioned, all of these were developed within the past 500 years, many of them within the past 150 years, and most of them within the past 80 years. And we could even go closer to us than that, couldn't we? The irony is that today, human beings have turned so many things that were so long considered unimaginable into reality, and yet we cannot or will not imagine God and His unimaginable power. Isn't that ironic? So what at one time is unbelievable because it's unimaginable can later become imaginable and believable. How many more things which today are unimaginable and unbelievable will become reality and thus become both imaginable and believable? Most importantly, how will the development of the unimaginable into reality change our thinking about what is believable? Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 24, tells of a man who brought his epileptic son to Jesus' disciples to be healed. When Jesus shows up in verse 17, the story begins to change. Jesus had asked about who the man was and why he was there. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought my son to you who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I ask you, your disciples, to drive out the spirit, but they could not. And Jesus replies, O unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground, rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, How long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And Jesus said, If you can, everything is possible for him who believes. That's a classic statement, isn't it? If you can, everything is possible for him who believes. Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you to come out of him and never enter him again. And so it was. This father was unsure that Jesus could heal his son. After all, others had tried and failed. It was only reasonable that he'd say, if you can. And yet, this unbelief that he admits to did not allow his doubt to keep him from believing and wanting to believe. He wanted to believe more. He wanted to have greater faith. He wanted his doubt replaced with faith. He wanted to be sure of who Jesus really is and what he could really do. He had nothing to lose, and he had everything to gain if he believed. Isn't that true for you and I today? Even if we're skeptical about what the Bible teaches, we have nothing to lose and everything to gain if we believe. Doubt is faith waiting to be strengthened. Doubt is faith waiting to be strengthened. We can help you with that if you'll allow us to, and if you'll come forward as we stand and sing this song.